So for the last 7 years, now it's been seven, it was six last year, seven this year, as parents, Areli and I, after 22 years of marriage, we have been chasing our children in multiple high schools. I think the journey began a little earlier. I want to count also middle school, but I just want to focus on high school, because high school were more, I guess, aggressive, longer seasons. But both of our girls, they play for the school band. So putting our girls together, they do a period of 6 years of high school. And then now our youngest still has two more years. So a total of eight is going to be at the end of the conversation that we are chasing these guys between football games and basketball games. And when you walk into football stadiums, you walk into high school gymnasiums, one of the things that you find and you see, especially in the gymnasiums, which are indoors, you see the rafters and you see banners hanging from the rafters. Or there might be some of them might be hanging on the walls. And they typically, what they tell you is the journey, the years, the championships, you know, whatever they have accomplished as a school in whatever particular sport. This verses 1 through 5 that you just read, I want you to read them and I want you to process them. That's what we're going for the next few minutes. As banners in the rafters hanging, you know, and specifically this guy by the name of John, which is the fourth gospel in the New Testament. He's walking us through the banners and saying, let me tell you how the journey happened, how it all began. Now, this is a very serious conversation for me. And again, if you walk into this place a while ago and you were given something that looks like this, you're going to see the little cover that the name of the series is O Come Emmanuel. But specifically, if you look at the handout, and I don't know if it's big enough for you to see it, but I'll put it to you on the screen. You see a little subtitle that says The Journey of the King. And this is a very important conversation for us because this is the beginning of Christmas. It's a special season for us as a church, as families. But my concern, and this is what I want you to kind of get your thinking hats for a second, is that those who have come and embraced Emmanuel, those who have come and trusted Jesus as personal Savior, and those who are thinking about it, so if you're thinking, hopefully you do that today, typically we approach, we celebrate, we come, we embrace Christianity, or in this case Christmas, for the purpose that He will bless our journey. And I say bless our journey because some of us, we come from a very difficult journey, past experiences, a journey that was questionable, a journey that was hurtful, a journey that we're trying to overcome, a journey that we might be facing consequences of that journey. So we come to Jesus and we embrace Christianity for the purpose to make things new. And Jesus can do that and has done some of those things already. Some of us, we approach Jesus and Christmas hoping that the future of our journey is blessed, is protected, is prosperous, is a journey that is pleasing, is a journey that I do not repeat the mistakes of the past, which, again, I'm not against those things. But the reason why we're having this conversation and we're embracing Christmas is because the lives of those who have embraced Christianity is about building our journey in the journey of Jesus. Now, let me explain to you what I mean by that. Because the unmovable journey of Jesus, we're about to dissect, the journey of Jesus, of Emmanuel, coming and dwelling among us and becoming a man through this, you know, Christmas experience, has to be the foundation of our journey. And by that, I do not mean, hear me say this closely, I'm not implying that whatever happened to you prior to Jesus, God approves it. See, Jesus has this ability that he will embrace you without approving what you have done. If you look at Jesus' interviews in the Gospels, he embraced and welcomed people. He just didn't approve everything that people did. Does that make sense? In other words, Jesus only co-signs experiences of the journey that they match with his journey. Now, some of these things that I'm speaking of, for some of us, they're in the past. So they're irreversible. Already happened. That's why it's called past, because it cannot be changed. But the supernatural power of Jesus, he has the ability to take the journey or the pilgrimage of people 2,000 years ago that they did some bad things. These people, this generation that Jesus came to, and he takes the brokenness and creates something beautiful out of this brokenness. I'm not saying that this is easy to do. I'm not saying that this is convenient. All that I'm saying is that what is unmovable is the journey of the King, and hopefully our lives, our journeys, are based on and built on that journey. Now, here's another reason why I believe this is true. It's because the beauty of the gospel, the beauty of Jesus, is that he has the ability to celebrate our differences. In other words, without Jesus, our differences become obstacles, become an indictment against each other, becomes controversial, becomes prejudices, becomes preconceived ideas, becomes, I mean, all this brokenness that we see all over the place when we disregard the journey of Jesus as a point of reference and begin with our personal journey. So once again, as you look at John chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, is basically the journey of this Messiah's arrival. Now, a couple of things before I go into the verse that I want, the verses we're going to look at. By the way, when I said the verses, inside your bulletin, there's a little handout that you guys can pull out and utilize as well. But let me say this very quickly, a couple of things about this journey. Number one, hear me say this closely. The author of this book is the fourth gospel in the Bible. So in the New Testament, you have Matthew, you have Mark, you have Luke, and then you have Brother John. Okay, so you have four gospels. If you think about the journey or the banners hanging in the rafters of the narrative of Jesus, the first gospel, which is Matthew, and I'm going to give you this little inside, so if you decide to read the Christmas story for your children at home, hopefully you read it maybe every night between now and Christmas Day, that you can read a little bit of the story from the scriptures. Matthew is the narrative of the Christmas story from the perspective of an angel speaking to this carpenter young man by the name of Joseph. It's the annunciation of Jesus' birth, and the angel says to Joseph, "Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife," and then goes into the story. That's Matthew. Second gospel, Mark. Mark skips basically 30 years of the life of Jesus, and he just presents Jesus as a grown Jewish man, 33 years of age, and he walks into this radical prophet, which I believe is the last prophet of the Old Testament, which is John the Baptizer. And he shows up to Joseph and says, to John the Baptizer, and he says, "You need to baptize me." So Mark begins with the baptism of Jesus, no Christmas story. Then Luke, which is the third gospel, he begins like Matthew with an interview between the angel, but not Joseph, but instead, who's the mother of Jesus? Mary. So it's Mary and the angel having this conversation, and then this beautiful, beautiful scenery where eventually, you know, Mary questions this, "How can this be possible? I do not know any man. How can I conceive?" And he says, you know, reminding himself about this prophecy of Isaiah 7:14, and then goes into this beautiful passage that you guys remember, that nothing is impossible. I mean, things that are impossible for men, with God, nothing is impossible. So that's the narrative. John, and this is where we're going for this month of December, John doesn't begin Christmas as the narrative, as an intro. If you look at John, what John is going to do, he's going to begin to introduce Jesus before the beginning of time. And this is important because, again, if you, and you already read this, so I'm going to skip the five verses. If you look at this conversation, this is the brother that among the disciples, the what you may call eyewitnesses of the ministry of Jesus, the book is written somewhere in between 70 to 90 years after Jesus. What's the implication? A couple of implications. Again, think about it. He's showing you the banners on the rafter, right? He's showing you the journey of Jesus. He's old. John is old. John, I mean, he's been through a lot. Part of the journey of John himself is that he saw the murder of Jesus. He saw the crucifixion of Jesus. He saw the resurrection of Jesus. He was the beloved disciple. Some people think that he was related to Jesus, like blood related to Jesus. He is the guy that is going to take care of Mary, the mother of Jesus, after Jesus is gone. And then this thing about John. John is the guy that is going to witness the murder and the killing of every one of the apostles. So John has seen it all. And when he is old and he's gone through all these things, when he approaches these writings, you got to remember that the same way that you send some texts this morning, some of you have texted already, some of you read some text this morning already. Some of you are texting right now. Shouldn't do that. But anyways, when you send a text, you have a recipient as the individual receiving your text. I don't know if you've ever been a place where you sent a text to the wrong person. Have you received a text that you're like, "I hope in your texting your wife, bro. I hope it's your wife. I know you were, and then obviously after that, oops, sorry, it wasn't for you. Okay, so there's always a recipient of the message, right? That's exactly the Gospels. John is writing with a specific audience in mind. The audience of John, he's old, he's beat up, he's close to basically go to Jesus. He's writing to the churches in Ephesus, to the churches in Asia Minor, 2,000 years ago, modern Turkey today. And he writes them in this amazing way to show them the rafters, to show them the journey of the king. And this is what he says, chapter 1, verse 1. It is in the beginning. So in your mind, please go to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. Genesis, the book that means beginning, says, in the beginning, God, what did he do? Created the heavens and the earth. This word beginning implies, here's the implication, that is before time began. In other words, what John is trying to help us understand is that the concept of beginning, and again, we're so limited for chronology, is that it is before we can set a point of references for chronology. If you read the Bible, if you go chapters 1 through 11 of Genesis, for instance, 1 through 11, those chapters were written in a time what we call pre-scientific, meaning before there was a point of reference in history. What does that mean? Look at me for a second. That implies that although it's true and although the author is inspired by God, the point of reference for Genesis 1 through 11 was not to convey the details on how it happened and when things happened. That's not the concern of the writer of those chapters in Genesis. The concern of the writer, because it involves the creation story and the flood and the Tower of Babel and all those things that we know, the point of the reference is who did it and why did he do it? So translate that into John when he says, in the beginning, what he's helping us to understand is if you're going to show your children and your grandparents or your friends the rafters and the banners hanging about the life of Jesus that you have experienced, you always began with something greater than your ability, greater than yourself. Well, what does that mean? Well, here's what it means. Again, John is writing to Christians. So I'm always concerned when the Bible is writing to Christians, which is most of the Bible. Why? Because Christians are so dysfunctional 2,000 years ago that I am hopeful about myself. I'm in good company. Because I'm just a fellow struggler. I mean, there are some things that I should have gotten, I should have already understood, I should have already practiced, and I'm so behind in so many things. And John writes to Christians, and he says, in the beginning. The issue with the churches in Ephesus, Christmas season, Christmas time for this people, is that they have gotten involved in something that you may describe today as progressive Christianity. There were four things that were happening in the churches, that the problems, and this is why he writes the way he writes. The first one is that they, the churches, the Christians, they were creating their own version of Christianity. So they, just like cell phones, you get the iPhone 5, 7, 8, whatever, 10. They created their own version of Christianity. So these churches, they embrace Jesus plus something else. They embrace Jesus plus Judaism, Jesus plus Roman philosophies and practices and deities. They embrace Jesus plus Gnosticism of Greek philosophies. So John writes and he says, in the beginning, that the antidote for you to remain pure and keep the centrality of Christmas or the gospel, you cannot add anything to the gospel. So the first thing is adding things to the gospel. Second thing is the concept that 2,000 years ago, the churches in this area of Asia Minor, they created a divorce between what they believed and how they behaved. So the divorce of right doctrine and proper ethical behavior. I unfortunately believe we're not too far from that today. So John is writing for the purpose to marry those things. The third reason is because of this mindset of Christianity 2,000 years ago that they were VIP. Meaning, what I mean by that is they embrace Christianity as long as Jesus endorsed their personal views, specifically ethnicity. So as long as Jesus is from the seed of Abraham, as long as Jesus is a Jew, as long as Jesus, I mean, on and on and on, which ironically, here's my point. Ironically, when you look at the narrative from the beginning, specifically in Genesis, from the very beginning, the whole concept of redemption to the world is universal. It's not ethnically driven. It's not about a specific group of people. It's about the world. So for those who have been selected, elected, chosen by God before the foundations of the world, if you want to embrace the doctrine of election, here's the crazy thing. Election in the Bible, in the Old Testament, which is the audience of these people, is for service. In the New Testament, it's for Christ-likeness. So it's never for a sense of, hey, look at me. I'm different. So translate that into the caravan of thousands of immigrants walking through the country of Mexico from Central and South America. Well, what does that mean for us as Christians? How do you see people that they may be struggling on identity issues? Well, these churches were struggling with the same thing. And John writes and says, Christmas is about understanding that Philippians chapter 2, being in equality with God, he did not consider that. We went through that in the previous series. The last one is the concept, conveniently, of self-indulgence, meaning that I'm so righteous, I'm so holy, I'm better than everybody else, coming as a connector to the VIP mindset. So I fulfill the law, and just picture churches in Asia Minor where you have a group of Jewish people who they will never touch machacado con huevo. And then you have another group of Greeks who all that they eat is chorizo. It's just, you know, just pork. I mean, and all these rules and regulations that they were so self-driven that it's just turmoil in the life of the church. The other kind of a side of the coin is that you have a bunch of people that they will say, well, Paul said there is justification for grace and faith alone in Jesus. So that means no matter what I do, I never lose my salvation. So I can go wild and crazy and keep my Greek practices, keep my views of sexuality and indulgence, but I'm saved, right? Well, again, those are the problems 2,000 years ago. And this is why John says, if you're gonna deal with the Christmas story in a manner that is going to remove all these blind spots that everybody has, no one is exempt from them, Christians especially, you have to understand that the message of Christmas is about the eternality, is the transcendence of Jesus of Nazareth. That although he will and he does become a man, his humanity is simply an addition to his divinity. That although he's 100% man, that this doesn't compromise his very essence. So what does that mean? Here we go. Let's talk about this for a second. Look at what he says. It is in the beginning, before the creation, before the conception of time, before the world was created, that this Jesus existed. John says that in the beginning was the Word. So again, who's the audience? Because depending on who you're sending the text to, that's how you text, correct? There are some things that only Areli gets from me via text. No one else. There are some things that my children get and no one else get on my text. I have a game that I get with my girls through Instagram that I send them private on private messages. I send them some pictures that remind them of Chucho, our dog, all the time. No one else gets those pictures except my girls. What's the point? The point is that since we have a specific audience, look at what's happening. When John says that in the beginning, assuming that we're moving back into the Alpha and Omega, beginning and end, the eternality of God, this is the way John is conveying to them three things about the birth of Jesus. Is that Jesus, in the very beginning, before the creation of time, there was a person. What does that mean? Look at me for a second. That implies that although the conception of Jesus in Mary's womb is an actual baby, it's not just tissue. Tracking what I'm saying? It's not just, I don't know if I need to go into that route, but Mary conceiving through the Holy Spirit, it is a person. But John is saying this is beyond Mary. Tracking what I'm saying? As important as Mary is to the story, the person of Jesus is before time. The word for the mindset of this audience is that God, before the creation of the world, he established a specific message. That when God spoke and he created the heavens and the earth, and he eventually from the dust, from the dirt of the ground, he made man, he made it for a specific message with a specific purpose. Unfortunately, Genesis chapter 3 is going to deviate the message. And the purpose, so listen for a second, because again, the audience of John is people who their Bible is the Old Testament. Tracking? That's their Bible. So what does that mean? That they understood that the message of God was exclusively conveyed. This is how God spoke to them. It spoke through prophets, it spoke through priests, and it spoke through kings. There were three main venues of God's communicating his voice. And in Jesus, through the Word, through the Word made flesh, is that Jesus embodies all those three. But here's the beauty of the gospel. That although he is saying to us that it was before the creation of time, Jesus was, that implies that Jesus not only conveys the message, but the message is not simply principles and good news and the transformation of situations. The message is a person. The message is, in other words, God, throughout history, he sent prophets, he sent priests, he sent kings. For the first time, Christmas, what it is, it's not kings or priests or prophets. It's God coming and dwelling among us. It's him becoming the message, him becoming the person that incarnates the message. And the last thing that you see in what is called this beautiful narrative of Hebrew poetry, Book of Psalms, Proverbs, is that the word is described also as wisdom. So the arrival of Jesus is the antidote. What will be the antidote, the opposite of wisdom? Foolishness? Stubbornness? See, Jesus is the fulfillment of the wisdom of God. So again, this is the beauty of this presence, that Jesus is from the beginning, that Jesus is literally a person, is the message, and Jesus is wisdom for those who seek the Lord. Look at what he says next. Once you go into this whole understanding of the transcendence of Jesus, the preeminence of Jesus, the exaltation of Jesus, and who this Word is, John says, in the Word that is at the beginning, what happens to this Word? In other words, this supremacy, this majesty, this message, this person, this wisdom is not self-service. That the journey of Jesus from the beginning of time and before the beginning of time, this whole journey that he chooses in his sovereignty to come and dwell in a third world country through, of all people in the world, a woman. Like you don't choose women in this time in history, right? Nothing against ladies, but if you want to do something transcendent and phenomenal, you choose people of influence. You choose the wisest. You choose the powerful people in the world. And he chooses something that no one has ever chosen before. See, this whole thing is about reminding us that this Jesus, this Word, was with God. So again, translate this into the Christmas narrative, because if Jesus is at the beginning, and only God is at the beginning, and the one who was at the beginning is Jesus, it is extremely important where he was at the beginning, and he was with God. So again, think about it for a second, because I don't know how to illustrate this better than this. So 22 years. For us, 22 years ago, that's when we experienced, can you guys give me the next slide, please? 22 years ago, that's when we went through the experience of marriage. That's what happened to, well, that's what happens after 22 years ago. You look like this. But anyways, so 22 years ago, we went through the experience where we're two individuals, and trust me when I tell you this, two individuals that we are, I don't know how to say this, but we are just opposites. Is that a fair statement? No one is better than the other. No one is right. The other one's wrong. It's just that we're opposite. Just obvious reasons. Look at lady, no lady. Tracking? Like lady and then manly men. Like two opposites. And I'm saying this because the purpose of this union is not that she becomes more like a man and I become more like a woman. It's not about just getting your feminine side. No. Listen to me. Marriage, in the eyes of God, is for one single purpose. And that purpose, for that matter, is not about feeling in love for 22 years. I'm not saying that I don't love my wife. I'm not saying that I have lost love for my wife. I'm not saying that I question loving my wife. Look at me. What I'm saying is that, biblically speaking, once again, the people in the Bible, like if you want to be honest on this regard, see, the Bible has more into the arranged marriage than actually the marriage that we do in Western civilization through feelings, right? I'm not promoting arranged marriage, although sometimes I think about it. But anyways, I'm not saying that we should choose, you know, spouses or your parents should choose who you marry. But all that I'm saying is that, you know, the Bible says in Genesis chapter 2 that the men shall live, father and mother, shall cling to the wife and become what? One flesh. So my point is that the purpose of marriage is that two individuals with different, you know, difference of personalities and very differently, uniquely different, those two, the purpose is oneness, that you will become one. How do I know this? Because right after this experience of beginning the journey of oneness, out of the oneness, three little ones came into the place. Sarai, Rebecca, and Josue. Because of the oneness, tracking? So emotionally, you are one, you know, mentally and spiritually, you become one into this. That's the purpose of marriage. So track this or connect that to the scriptures. When John says that the Word was with God, it's exactly the concept that for the audience, again, the audience of John, all that they know, okay, let me put it this way. Let me rephrase that. The audience of John, one of the uniqueness of Christianity is exactly monotheism. The word mono means one God. Like Greeks coming into Christianity, they come from a multiplicity of gods, deities. Jewish people coming into Christianity, they come from the one true God. Romans coming into Christianity, they come from the pantheon and they come from all these diverse views and the barbarians. See, Christianity is about, this is the uniqueness of Christianity, that there is one God, but this God is three. Say it. Three what? Three persons. So if you come back into the marriage component, we are two people, although this crazy country of ours, I'm afraid to say this, but I'm going to have to say it. Before I died, which I hope to die old, I think I'm going to get to see the legalization of polygamy, but that's a different component where you're going to see pictures with multiple wives and husbands, but that's a different conference for a different day. All that I'm trying to tell you is that just look at the scriptures. Is one God three persons? In marriage, you have two persons moving into oneness. So John says that he is at the beginning, that he is the Word that is at the beginning, and this Word is with God. So the purpose of this triune God is that the Christmas experience is the expression of the intimacy of the fellowship between them. And here's what I want you to hear this, because this intimacy with God between the three persons is not for the purpose so you can simply avoid hell and go to heaven. It's not for the purpose that you can see the fulfillment of the prophecies given by the prophets in the Old Testament, although this is important. It's not simply so Jerusalem becomes the epicenter of culture and worship and the nations come and worship the one true God. That's important. But the intimate fellowship between the Godhead, which what makes one pretzel is three holes, what makes God, God, is three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, this intimacy that if you were to break the pretzel and you take one hole out of the three holes, you lose the pretzel. The pretzel becomes incomplete. The same thing with God. You cannot break the three persons within the Godhead. Hear me say this. This intimacy that the Bible describes in the fellowship of the one God with the three persons is so we can emulate that. What does that mean? That means that if this is the blueprint for relationships, the way that John describes, and John is saying that in the beginning was Jesus, and he was in intimate fellowship with God, Jesus dwelling among us is so we can have that intimacy with God and also with one another. So today, what I'm going to invite you to do, and this is how I want you to close our conversation today, that if Jesus is before time, and he was present before time, and his presence was to accentuate the fellowship with God, look what the purpose of that fellowship is for. The purpose of that fellowship is not so you can improve your fellowship. It's not so you can have a better relationship with God, although I want you to have a better relationship with God. The purpose of the intimacy that the Word was at the beginning with God is so you can see that the most important relationship in your life is the relationship of God among himself. That implies that as you relate to God, listen to me, as you relate to God the way Jesus relates to God. You don't get to define what does it mean to believe in God. You don't get to define what Christmas is. You don't get to define what marriage is. You don't get to define, I don't get to define what life is. This intimacy is for the purpose that at the end, in Jesus, in the Word that was at the beginning, in the Word that existed from the beginning, in the Word that was with God, literally that Word is God. And this God, this Jesus, literally existed from the beginning. So as you think of this beautiful season of the year, would you open your heart to the possibility that as you go through this season, through this month, through this experience, that this is the experience that you bring your life into. That Jesus, 2,000 years ago, had a birthday. I don't understand how this works, but the God who is beyond time decided to confine his very own self into the concept of the 9th month of pregnancy gestation. That there is a specific point in human history when Mary brought forth a child. There is a specific time in human history when this baby boy started talking and walking and crying, and he started teething. That this baby boy, chronologically, he limited himself, and the limitation of Jesus about himself is for the purpose that today you can embrace that this is the same Jesus, the same God from the beginning that existed, and he dwells with God, and he is beyond our time, that he is the one who birthed the days of this world. That he's the creator of every single thing. Now, why this is relevant? Because last week I told you, I don't know if you were here, I don't know if you remember this, but between services, there was a brother from our church that came and approached me in between services and said, I need to pray for me, pray for us. And I said, what's going on? And he said, my nephew got killed on Thanksgiving night. And we're trying to figure out what we're going to do. I mean, this is my sister's son. And we talk about it for a little while. And when he told me about the death, the sudden death of the son, tragically through a motorcycle accident, my heart just sank in between services, because I can only imagine that specifically on Thanksgiving, can you imagine? And by the way, this morning at 10 o'clock was the last funeral service, and tomorrow morning is burial. So can you imagine what Thanksgiving is going to be for this family? Between now and Jesus' return, can you imagine what Christmas is going to be? Well, what's the point? Here's the point, that when you go through the seasons in life, that chronology is not enough. That although your son is going to be placed tomorrow at a burial with 2 dates on it, logically speaking, children bury parents, not the other way around. Parents are not supposed to be the 2 dates of a son. Tracking? That's the moment when you move from the sensical, from your senses of sight and touch and smell and all the senses that we have into what I would call the nonsensical. When you go into the understanding that Jesus is the combination of both, that he is the God who came and dwelt among us to remind us that he is God himself. That his limitation as a human being is for the purpose that you will recognize the fullness of the God who gives birth and is beyond death. That 2,000 years ago, this Jesus who limited himself and he became a human, and in the condition of human, he became a servant. And then from servanthood, he went to death, and death on a cross is for the purpose that he will conquer moments like what this family is going through. That the pain is present, and the pain and the suffering is temporary. That there is a day where this kingdom will be restored for those who have followed Jesus of Nazareth. So this morning, my invitation is simple, that you will recognize. And hear me say this closely. My invitation is that you and I learn to marry these two principles before we need it. Before you have to think beyond the senses, before you have to put into practice beyond the concept of trusting in the trustworthiness of Jesus. Because to embrace this is simple. See, this right here, just deli hasta males. We're going to eat a lot of those. right? Christmas is beautiful, the lights and the gifts and the presents and the baby in a manger. This right here, to trust Jesus as the creator of life when life has been taken away from me, when life has no meaning for me because what I feel and what I'm experiencing. If you remember the story, it is within the next few years, and this is why I'm so kind of a touchy on the subject. You know, within the next 2 years, Jesus is going to become, he's going to become an exile. He's going to go into a caravan into Egypt. Remember that? So I'm thinking of the families walking through Mexico and just being a couple of miles from us, that they are immigrants, illegal immigrants, searching. And whatever your political views are on this, Jesus went through that. Does that make sense? I'm thinking, and I'm reminded that it is baby Jesus who, after going to Egypt, in the transition of going to Egypt, again, exile, running away from his life, when he returns, can you imagine? I mean, this is a, where Jesus was born is a small community with a couple of hundred people. So when the Bible says that the edict came from the Romans to slaughter all baby boys, remember the story? Can you imagine Jesus coming back for the first time and families looking around says, see, Jesus is a reminder of my 2-year-old. Because when Mary had a baby, I also had a baby boy. Mine didn't make it. I'm thinking of Moses. Moses is a reminder of failure. Because if you're Moses back in Egypt, Moses is a reminder that my son didn't make it, but he made it. So I don't know if you've ever been in a place where your life is a reminder of tragedy. I don't know. I have. And what you do when your life is involved with tragic events and the grief and the unthinkable and the irreversible of life is that you learn to trust that the same God that has a birthday is the God that also births all the days.